You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Microplastic pollution is getting more attention and research in the last few years. It's been discovered in oceans, the Great Lakes, even in beer. There's a lot of reasons microplastics get into the environment. One way is from our clothing. Throwing out clothes with synthetic fibers, even doing the laundry, can release those microplastics. But there are some ways we can help cut down on our pollution footprint. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you avoid things like plastic or synthetic fibers when you are shopping for clothes? Do you try to seek out more natural fibers? Are you stymied trying to get the clothes you want and the fabrics you want? Do you have questions about whether sustainable clothing really is so sustainable? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Allison Chu is a reporter covering climate solutions for the Washington Post. She's written about microplastics in our clothes and what happens when we donate our clothing. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Do we have a sense of how large a pollutant microplastics from our clothes are compared to the other many sources of microplastics?
It's a great question. The experts that I spoke to while I was doing my reporting, generally say that when it comes to the overall plastics problem, you know, we know that that's massive, but microplastics are a significant portion of the plastic pollution that winds up in our waterways. And the tough thing about microplastics is, you know, in the name, they're very, very small bits. You know, they can easily go down the drain, end up in our wastewater, end up in rivers and oceans. And in some cases, you know, they can also be small enough to be sort of released into the air, depending on, you know, where they're coming from. And so with things like clothes, you know, microfibers are a type of microplastic, and it can come from, in many cases, it can come from sort of synthetic fabrics like polyester. And you know, whenever you're beating your clothing around in the washing machine or in the dryer, or even sometimes with the friction of just wearing it, those really small fibers can shed.
And what are some of the harms we know about so far of having lots of these microfibers in things like our waterways?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that they can get everywhere, and not only in the environment, but also inside people's bodies. Researchers are telling me that the understanding of the impacts of microplastics on human health is still being studied, but there is some research on certain animals showing that exposure to microplastics can cause some negative health effects.
And you, in your recent piece, looked at, you know, what we as consumers can do to try to avoid releasing these microfibers from our clothing. What are some of the things that seem to make the most difference?
It's a really great question, and it is really hard to put the onus on consumers when it comes to this type of problem, because as many experts that I spoke with highlighted, the big fix is obviously changing the type of textiles that we use in a lot of clothing, but that's understandably a very big undertaking, and that requires change from industry and manufacturers. So in the meantime, unfortunately, it does sort of fall on the consumer to try to navigate the types of clothing that they're buying, and then how they're taking care of it, and such, and especially with the washing and the drying. There are things that you can put into your washing machine or dryer, whether they're bags or balls or filters that go, that you can add to your appliances that to a certain degree do filter and capture the microfibers. And those have been tested in studies and, can be effective to a certain degree. Doesn't capture all of the fibers. There are some people who might think, if we know that the microplastic microfibers are mostly coming from synthetic materials, then I'll just go buy natural things. But one expert that I spoke with noted that, you know, there have been studies showing that natural fabrics will also shed fibers. And even though the fiber is from a quote unquote natural source, you know, once it's been turned into clothing, a lot of the cases, you know, it's been chemically treated and things like that. And so we really don't know how quickly even the quote unquote natural fibers are going to degrade, you know, in a natural environment. So again, this is maybe frustrating for some consumers to hear, but it is fairly complicated. And sometimes it can feel a little bit outside of control. But like I said earlier, there are different things you can add to your appliances. One fairly maybe sort of no-brainer step is you could wash and dry your clothes less. Mm. So not everything has to be washed every time you wear them. Even though, you know, it is kind of very easy to toss it into the hamper, but sometimes it's a little bit of intentional thinking about, I wore this, you know, polyester t-shirt one time. Do I really have to throw it into the wash?
We're talking to Allison Chu from the Washington Post about microplastics, microfibers, and other fibers in our clothing, how we can try to keep them from getting into the environment. She stays with us. Right now, we're going to zoom in on the fashion industry and what goes into choosing the fabrics in our clothes. Sarah Eileen Smith is a fashion and retail lecturer at UW-Stout. She teaches about garment engineering and production. I talked with her yesterday. Here's a listen. Now, we hear about fibers, microfibers from our clothing, making it into the environment. What kinds of materials are those coming from?
All of those microfibers that you're thinking about are going to be from our synthetic fibers. So things like polyester, nylon, acrylic, a lot of things that we're really used to seeing in our wardrobes. So you're definitely going to be seeing synthetics responsible for some of those microfibers, aka microplastics that are entering our waterways.
When it comes to clothing design, what affects the decision of whether to use these petroleum-based plastic fibers in a garment?
A lot of what is actually influencing our fabric choice is the actual function of the garment. So what we expect it to actually do, what you want to wear it for, whether that's a product that you're going to be wearing when you're playing in a football game, or if it's something that you're going to wear to the beach, or something you'll wear to work in a corporate office. The fabric needs to be compatible with the end product. So that choice is going to be made really early on, and it's going to be very intentional based on the actual product you're trying to make. So whether or not the fiber is synthetic or natural in origin, like cotton or wool or something like that, is definitely going to be determined by what's the best choice for the product.
If, as a consumer, I carefully avoid all plastic products, only natural fibers, am I getting away clean? There's no downstream impact from fibers from my clothing, or are there still concerns?
Well, that's a great question. And I would say I would commend you, first of all, if you were able to do that and have your entire wardrobe be all naturally produced fibers, because we're so reliant in the masses on synthetic fibers. To answer your rootier question here, it is also tied into how do we actually dispose of our products. So no matter if it's a synthetic fiber or if you have a natural fiber, 100% organic cotton, if you throw that into the trash and it goes into a landfill, neither option is going to degrade at a natural rate. So that can be a real problem when we're thinking about cradle to cradle or something that we want to make sure doesn't have a negative impact on the environment. If we're just throwing it in a landfill, it can contribute to all the issues that we see from landfills. There's a lot of data out there about how synthetic fibers take a really long time to decompose and they don't degrade naturally, things like plastics. But if you're throwing that 100% organic cotton t-shirt into the landfill, depriving it of oxygen, it's not going to degrade the way it would if it were to be composted. So you would definitely see some ramifications in terms of the entire life cycle of the garment, even if you were able to make all of those perfectly educated choices on your fiber types.
Now, moving toward the front end here, there is a lot of concern out there, it seems like, about microplastics. Do you see clothing designers and manufacturers in any way moving away from the synthetic products that raise those microplastic concerns?
There are some companies out there that are definitely trying to address this. Part of the problem is that we don't think about what's happening to our clothes when they're in the wash and dry cycle, when we're actually laundering them. Those products that are made of synthetic fibers that go through your washing machine, naturally in the washing machine, clothes abrade against one another, and that takes some of the fibers away from the products that can wash out in the laundering. And then you get more agitation when you put it in the dryer. So a lot of simple things that you could see a manufacturer do is to suggest hang drying or flat drying products, because you'll get less agitation by not putting it through the dryer. It'll make your clothes last longer. Now that puts the onus on the actual consumer rather than on themselves. So there are definitely some choices being made about how do we manufacture products from the start that are going to be the most friendly. And then you do see companies taking initiatives like selling little filters you can put on your washing machine at home that should catch most of the microfibers or microplastics that are entering through the laundering system. But again, that's put on the consumer. So there are some changes being made, but our demand for products and the price point that we're willing to pay is going to influence what the opportunities are as well from a manufacturer standpoint.
And before I let you go, Sarah Eileen, I want to ask about durability as a factor in sustainability. We see a lot of these so-called fast fashion things, real cheap, but not designed to last a whole long time. How big an issue in sustainability is, you know, that article of clothing that's going to last five wears versus going to last 5 years?
This is a huge thing for consumers right now. And the change that we're seeing from sustainable companies is that they're thinking more about this. They're trying to do away with the fast fashion aspect. I see this with my students a ton. They generally are going to be from Gen Z. They're more concerned with shopping secondhand. They're thinking more about where their products come from and how can they get longevity out of them. So part of it is you make a choice that's best for you. With durability in terms of the garment itself, a garment can be very durable, whether it's synthetic or it's actually natural fibers. Oftentimes with synthetic fibers, we can make specific choices in the formula we're actually extruding to create fibers, and those choices can make it extra strong. So we do have more control over that from synthetics, but we know that we have really good fibers that are natural that can stand the test of time. We were using cotton and wool and many different natural fibers long before we even had synthetics. And we have products that still exist from over 100, 200 years ago. You can go to museums and see products that have no synthetic fibers and they are still surviving. So part of it is going to be how we choose as consumers to interact with this idea of durability. But another part is that we see a lot of retailers actually reacting to the idea of how can I inspire my customer to actually make the sustainable choice and support our sustainable mission. And we're seeing a lot of consumers really excited about that. So it's kind of like a grassroots movement, and we're getting more and more traction as we go.
Sarah Eileen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a great, great time.
That was Sarah Eileen Smith, fashion and retail lecturer at UW-Stout. In just a minute, we're going to bring Allison Chu of the Washington Post back into the conversation about clothing, pollution, and sustainability. Coming up, we'll look at Allison's reporting on what happens when you donate your clothing, your old clothing. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on sustainability and clothing. Do you think about sustainability when you're buying clothes, or is it all about price, fit, and fashion? If so, you're not alone. Do you look for only natural fibers or things that are produced in a more environmentally acceptable way to you? And what happens at the end of your clothing's life? Do you donate it? Do you wonder what happens when you do donate it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up that conversation on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Allison Chu is with us, climate solutions reporter at the Washington Post, to talk about clothing, how it can be a source of microplastic pollution, what happens to our clothes when we throw them out or donate them. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you want to share how you shop for clothes, if you look at labels for particular ingredients, materials to avoid or chase after? What do you do with your clothes when you're done with them? Call 800-642-1234. Allison, you did a piece on that exact question. What happens to clothing when it goes away from us? What did you learn when you looked into clothing donations?
It's really fascinating. I feel like I always think about the questions that I have with my clothes, and one of them, what happens when I drop it off at my local donation center? And as I realized through my reporting, they're donating is a fantastic way to get rid of your old clothes without, directly having them end up in a landfill. But at the same time, there are, I think, some classic mistakes that I know I've made myself and people that I've talked to have made, where sometimes, we're just not donating in the most intentional way. And in those cases, you can potentially, do more harm than good in some of those situations. So that was really fascinating to learn about, because as one of the people that I spoke to noted, there is this idea when it comes to donating clothes that whatever you give is going to go to a good home, and someone is going to love this top or these pants that I don't want anymore. And that's really not always the case.
What are some of the things to definitely not do when we donate?
I think first and foremost is obviously not donating anything that is, visibly wet or soiled in some way, or, just completely unwearable. Some larger donation places will take things that are a little stained or ripped. But if it's really gross and you probably wouldn't wear it, donating it is not a great idea. Some other things to keep in mind is, donating clothing, in the correct season. So, a great example of that is don't donate your heavy winter coats or sweaters in the summer. That's not something that's going to be in high demand when the weather is warm. But you can save that to donate, in the fall or in the winter.
We're talking about clothing and sustainability with Allison Chu from the Washington Post. Let's bring on a caller. Roseanne is with us in Wausau. Roseanne, hi.
Hi. Say, my question has to do with microfibers getting into the air. Your guest said that when we shake them and move, articles of clothing and whatnot, that these fibers can get into the air. And when I think about infant sleepers made from fleece, throws, blankets, even our stuffed animals, I'm wondering, are we constantly breathing in, and our children constantly breathing in these microfibers into our lungs? Has there been any research on that?
Roseanne, thanks for the call. Allison, I don't remember in your piece if any experts brought up the issue of potentially inhaling microfibers directly from the stuff as we're wearing it.
It's a great question. I don't believe that was covered in the reporting that I did. And as we talked about earlier, the understanding of the health impacts of having microfiber, microplastics in our bodies is still being studied. We do, there is research out there saying that, finding that it has, microplastics are in our bodies, but exactly what the impact of that is health-wise is still being understood. But we do have research suggesting that, when you throw your clothes into the dryer and it's tumbling around in there and there's a dryer exhaust, fibers can be released in that way, or as we talked about, it can be some can be released as you're rubbing around wearing your clothes, but the exact health impacts still being researched at the time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Roseanne. Now, Allison, people concerned about sustainability of their clothing might look for labels that give them cues. In your reporting, if we see things that are labeled as sustainable or eco-friendly or whatever, can we put a lot of stock in those kind of statements made by clothing manufacturers?
It's definitely a complicated question. There is a lot of greenwashing that happens in the fashion industry. So, there are things where maybe it sounds really great, it sounds super sustainable, but in reality, it's not as transformative as the marketing makes it seem, mm-hmm. basically. And so, the sustainable fashion experts that I spoke to about this, you know, they all really emphasize that at the moment, right now, it is again on the consumer to dive into research, really look into brands, see if you know, once you go to websites and things like that, you know, are they really backing up the sustainability claims that they make? You know, do they have these third-party reports assessing their manufacturing and supply chain process? Do their clothes come with sort of some of the widely accepted certifications, whether it's organic or, you know, whatever else? And there are databases of certifications. There are a lot of groups that have searchable databases for brands and things like that to again, really help consumers try to navigate whether a company that says they're being sustainable is actually, you know, putting actions to those words.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That's Allison Chu, reporter covering climate solutions for The Washington Post. She talked to us about her recent reporting on how to cut down on microplastic pollution coming from our clothes. We also heard from garment design expert Sarah Eileen Smith from UW-Stout. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Texas judge overturned the FDA's approval of a drug used in abortions, and things are up in the air in the midst of appeals to that ruling. Get the latest on that and some other big legal issues in the post-Roe v. Wade world. And join the search for some of Wisconsin's most majestic birds. Find out how you can get involved in the annual crane count here in the state and check in on the well-being of Wisconsin's sandhills and the whoopers. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the diabetes drug Ozempic is being used for weight loss as well, and there's a lot of hype around it. A Wisconsin diabetes doctor tells us about the medication and answers some common questions. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. economy added more than 200,000 jobs in March, despite another recent rise in interest rates. We'll talk to a Wisconsin economist about the latest numbers and what they mean for our day-to-day finances. First, you may have run across the name Ozempic lately. It's a drug used in the treatment of type 2 diabetes. But it's seen a growth in off-label use as a weight loss medication. Some doctors are prescribing it that way, some people are shopping for it that way, and a related drug called Wegovy has been approved by the FDA for weight loss. But there are a lot of open questions about who should and shouldn't use these medications. So, we've got a UW doctor who's an expert on diabetes treatment and research to help tackle some of these questions. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this diabetes medication, Ozempic? It's used for diabetes or for weight loss. Do you use it for either purpose? If you work in healthcare, are you getting a lot of questions about this right about now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Dawn Belt Davis is the director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center and professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's also section chief of the endocrinology at the VA in Madison. Dr. Davis, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk about Ozempic, first of all, in its originally intended use for treatment of type 2 diabetes? What does Ozempic do?
Sure. So Ozempic is a brand name for the drug, generic drug name is semaglutide. And this is part of a whole class of medications. There's actually several different types of medication in this group of therapies. And the way these drugs work is they were designed to treat type 2 diabetes, and they work by mimicking a hormone that your body makes naturally. So they're mimicking a hormone called GLP-1. And this hormone GLP-1 is normally produced by your body in these hormonal cells that in the gut, and it helps to regulate the way you process food by stimulating the release of insulin. So it helps your body to create more insulin and clear that blood sugar or blood glucose from your system. It also has some effects on promoting slowing down of the emptying of the stomach and promoting the feeling of satiety or feeling full after you eat a meal. So all of these things have positive benefits for patients with type 2 diabetes and additionally can promote some weight loss as well.
For people with type 2 diabetes, is the current state of affairs, hey, if you have type 2 diabetes, you should be taking one of this class of drugs, or is this just selected patients or very few? How commonly used is this?
I would say they're quite commonly used, and their use has really been increasing over the recent years for a few reasons. One is that, again, more and more of these drugs have been making it to market, and they've become easier and easier for patients to take. So, for example, Ozempic is a medication that, although it is an injection that patients have to take, they only have to do the injection once per week. So that really makes it convenient and easy for patients to use. And additionally, drugs in this this class, they have some additional benefits beyond just lowering blood glucose levels or blood sugar levels. As we mentioned, they also promote some weight loss. They have been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease outcomes, and also have some potential benefit in kidney disease in patients with diabetes. So we're using them more and more in our patients with diabetes, both to help manage their blood sugars, but also for these additional benefits that they provide.
Now, I'm guessing that this isn't the only thing somebody with type 2 diabetes might be doing. There might be other medications or lifestyle changes. Like, I'd love there to be a miracle cure, Dr. Davis. I'm assuming it isn't just this, though?
Correct, right. I mean, so this is just one part of our, one kind of tool in our toolbox that we have to treat our patients with type 2 diabetes. Lifestyle changes are always kind of the cornerstone of our treatment recommendations, but we know that lifestyle changes lifestyle changes alone are often not enough to really fully adequately treat patients with type 2 diabetes. So they often need medications in addition to lifestyle changes. And those medications can include all kinds of things, medications that have been around for decades, newer medicines like things like Ozempic, and then we also use insulin quite commonly in our patients with type 2 diabetes as well.
For Ozempic and other medications in this class, side effects, what kind of side effects do people sometimes see?
Sure. The most common side effect with drugs in this group is nausea and vomiting, and sometimes some other stomach upset like diarrhea or bloating. That happens pretty commonly. I would say up to 30% or more of patients will have some nausea and vomiting with this drug. And that's really the most common thing. We also do worry a little bit about potentially rare complications with this drug, including some patients do seem to have an increased risk of something called pancreatitis, which is inflammation of the pancreas. And we also see a slightly increased heart rate in patients taking these medicines, which isn't a big deal for a lot of people unless they already have a problem with, arrhythmias or other problems with their heart.
Talking to Dr. Dawn Davis with the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, looking at Ozempic and other drugs in its class. Used more and more commonly for people with diabetes, helps with glucose, as we've heard, helps with weight loss for people with diabetes. And there it is, a lot of people interested in that weight loss aspect of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions. If you've explored using this drug for either or both purposes, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Davis, Ozempic and other drugs in the news as people look at them as a possible weight loss use. How do you evaluate people saying, okay, I don't have diabetes, but I would like to lose weight. Maybe I should check these drugs out. What kind of things should people be thinking about?
Sure. So the same drug, I mentioned the generic name for Ozempic is semaglutide. And the same drug, semaglutide, is actually approved for weight loss in patients without diabetes. And that drug is marketed under the brand name Wegovy. And Wegovy was approved in summer of 2021, specifically for the treatment of weight loss. And so there are options to use these medications for patients without diabetes to help promote weight loss. The issue really has been around availability, and the Wegovy, although it was approved in 2021, it really wasn't available due to a lot of manufacturing issues and shortages. And so that really limited the use of Wegovy, and a lot of patients switched over to just using Ozempic, which is truly the same drug. It's just packaged and marketed in different doses and different different ways. But that impacted the availability of Ozempic for a lot of patients who were using it for type 2 diabetes.
Now, with any medication, from aspirin to Zyrtec, you're trading off benefits and risks and costs and possible side effects. Is that calculation different, Dr. Davis, from someone who's, you know, seriously overweight to the point where that's causing direct health threats versus, say, a Hollywood actor who wants to keep off 3 or 4 pounds for their next role? Does that calculation look different?
Absolutely. And so, you know, we don't recommend the use of these drugs for weight loss for patients who are only, you know, who are not actually clinically overweight. These medications are approved for patients with a body mass index greater than or equal to 30, or a body mass index greater than or equal to 27 with some related medical problem. So no, they shouldn't be used in people who maybe just have a couple extra pounds to lose and are not actually clinically overweight. And yeah, like anything, there are potential risks and side effects. And so there should be a health benefit from that weight loss that offsets those risks and side effects. And, you know, if you, again, don't have clinically meaningful excess weight to lose, then we wouldn't recommend the use of these medications.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Madison. Anne, hello.
Hi. I am type 2 diabetic, and I'm clinically overweight and was prescribed Ozempic and had high hopes for it. But after I took my second dose, the left side of my tongue just ballooned, swelled way up, and I had to go to urgent care and get an antidote. And then they took me off it. I can't take it because of the side effect.
And thanks for calling and sharing that story. I'm not a doctor. We can't diagnose over the phone. Of course, Dr. Davis, it sounds like some kind of allergic or other reaction. Is that something right. We commonly see with drugs in this class?
You know, we don't see a lot of allergic reactions, but they certainly can happen. And that's a perfect example of, you know, that any kind of medication we're using, there is always a risk of a side effect or an allergic reaction. So it sounds like in this case, it was an appropriate choice to try to use this medication, but it may not be safe for everyone. And the other thing I would point out too, is that these medications aren't effective 100% of the time. If we look at the clinical trial data, you know, about 75% of patients taking these drugs get the expected benefit, but about 25% don't really respond. So it's not necessarily the magic bullet that we would hope it would be.
And thanks again for sharing your experience. I'm glad, I'm sorry that this didn't work out for you. I'm glad you shared your story, though. Dr. Dawn Davis is with us, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center. We're looking at this diabetes drug, Ozempic, and related medications. They're getting a lot of hype as weight loss aids. We're checking out the pros and cons, things to think about, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been hearing about this drug at the Oscars from your friends? Are you or someone you know using it to control diabetes, to try to lose weight, for both? Have you had trouble getting it if you use it for diabetes? We'll talk about issues with availability. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Dr. Dawn Davis, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, looking at diabetes treatment and weight loss and a prescription medication called Ozempic and other medications in the same category. You can join in if you have questions, maybe an experience to share using it, dealing with patients who use it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Josie is with us on the way to Iron Mountain. Josie, hi.
Hi. Yes, I was, I'm asking actually for a relative who's morbidly obese but not non-diabetic. Would this be appropriate, and is it covered by insurance?
Josie, thanks for that call. Dr. Davis, I don't know if you heard of that connection. A relative obese, Josie says, not diabetic. Might this be appropriate, and would it be covered by insurance?
Yeah, that's thanks for the great question. Yes, these are drugs can be helpful for patients, like I said, with obesity who don't have diabetes. It is important, though, I think, to recognize that, you know, even best case scenario, sometimes patients on these drugs will lose 10, maybe 15% of their body weight. So although that's great, it's not necessarily going to be the dramatic change that some people are looking for. But we do know that 10 to 15% of body weight loss is great in terms of helping improve your metabolic health and your overall health. So even though it may not be the cosmetic outcome people are looking for, it can still be very helpful clinically in improving their health. In terms of insurance coverage, that's another great question. I think these medications are sometimes difficult to get insurance coverage for. They are very expensive, they are new, and they are injectables. And insurance companies will sometimes cover them for diabetes, but not for obesity. And sometimes they will cover them for obesity, but only with very strict criteria. So it can be challenging to get insurance to pay for these medications.
Josie, thanks a lot for those questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, you mentioned that the Wegovy had some availability problems. I've been seeing reports that Ozempic, people who rely on it for diabetes might have trouble getting it because of a surge of interest from people interested in it solely for the weight loss side of things. Is that something you've heard about from your colleagues or encountered yourself?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we don't know exactly where the shortages are coming from, but yes, there have been shortages of Wegovy and Ozempic over the past year or two. And they've been pretty severe in that we literally could not even get these drugs for a period of time. And we had to switch patients to other medications in many examples. I think, you know, the thought is that some of that might be driven by people taking it what we sometimes call off-label, like for reasons where they may not necessarily have a clinical need for the drug. But I think it's also being driven by just increased use in patients with type 2 diabetes and obesity, and just overall supply chain problems. The real concern I think we have is that, you know, if there's a drug that is in short supply, we certainly would want that drug to go to the patients who need it the most and not to the patients who don't necessarily need it clinically. So that's where the use of it, by celebrities to lose that 5 pounds comes into play, that if they get the drug and my patient with type 2 diabetes does not, that's kind of the problem.
Talking to Dr. Dawn Davis, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the diabetes medication Ozempic and some of its relatives, getting a lot of hype for use in weight loss. Still time for your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, I want to talk about duration of use. I assume somebody who's treating diabetes with something like Ozempic is going to keep using it for quite a long time. Someone might hope with weight loss to lose X number of pounds and then stop using it. Does it work that way, or is there a problem if that happens?
Right. So I think the issue is that if you discontinue using these drugs, most likely patients will regain at least some of the weight back. We don't have a lot of data really to look at that discontinuation phase. We know that, but we do know that with discontinuation, often we see weight regain with most of our medicines for weight loss. So in type 2 diabetes, yes, we typically would have a patient remain on this for an extended period of time. until either they, you know, don't tolerate it or have some other reason to stop it. For weight loss right now, the idea is that, yes, patients would stay on it for many years, which, again, gets to be an issue in terms of cost and other, you know, potential concerns with long-term exposure to side effects, et cetera.
And Dr. Davis, I wanted to ask, you treat people with diabetes. You also do research. What kind of things do you have your eye on for the future of diabetes treatment?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that are, you know, things that we're really looking forward to. I think that we have really grown a lot in terms of our ability to treat type 2 diabetes over the last 10 or 15 years. We have a lot of new drugs that we can use. But unfortunately, one of the things we're still lacking is things that get at kind of the root cause of diabetes and are really helpful in prevention. So some of the work we're doing in my research lab and others is trying to find ways to help the beta cells, which are the cells that make insulin, you know, grow and survive under the kind of stressful conditions of obesity and diabetes, with the hope that if we can promote that, we can keep insulin production ongoing in patients who are at risk of diabetes and hopefully prevent it or certainly make that diabetes less severe in the long run. So that's one of the things we're working on.
Time for one more caller. Lou is with us in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Lou, hi.
Hi there. I was calling in regards to a question I had with the Adderall. I am having, the Ozempic would make a difference for me too. I mean, I'm a diabetic, but Adderall, and I don't know what it is, but it's and I've been on this stuff for 25 years. I'm 70 years old, but it is totally dried up. Everywhere I go, I cannot find it in any pharmacies, whether it's way down south or way up here, the big Walmarts, the Walgreens.
I gotcha. No. Lou, there is an Adderall shortage out there. I know, Dr. Davis, I don't know if that's what you've been following. And Adderall not usually used directly for diabetes. I understand it can actually make it a little tricky to treat diabetes. Do you have thoughts for Lou?
Yeah, I mean, right. Adderall is not something we use for the treatment of diabetes, but it's just one example of many, many, many examples of drug shortages that we've seen over the last several years. You know, I mean, we always struggle with drug shortages. I think the pandemic made things a lot worse over the last few years, but it's really an issue. A lot of times patients really struggle to get medications they absolutely need. And, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are often, you know, doing the best they can, but things come up and we really struggle with how best to manage this. Ideally at a national level, we'd have a way to kind of, again, allocate and move resources around so patients could access things that they need.
Thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Davis, bringing things home to our conversation about Ozempic, diabetes, and weight loss. As you've mentioned, these are still, in the scope of things, fairly new drugs. What are some of your big unanswered questions when it comes to the use of this class of drugs, both for diabetes and for weight loss?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the big unanswered questions I think we have is going to be understanding, you know, if are there some reasons why certain patients respond well to these medications and others just don't have the same response? That's certainly something we're interested in and that we've even been looking at on the research side as well. And I think the other thing, as we talked a little bit about too, is, you know, are these drugs something that we really need to keep patients on forever to continue getting the sustained benefits? Or could we perhaps do some sort of short-term treatment and then maybe a retreatment in the future? These are all very open questions that we need to answer as we move forward.
And Dr. Davis, I've been at this in the media for a while. It seems like miracle weight loss products come and go. Some are scams. Some turn out to be not that useful. Some are harmful. It sounds like Ozempic has some promise, especially for people in more dire states, but it's not the miracle weight loss supplement that people might be hoping for. Do I have that about right?
I mean, I think so. It's certainly one of the best we have available and one of the best we have had available. And I'd say the overall side effects are good. Like the safety here is a lot better than some of the other medicines we've had in the past. There's a new medicine that just got approved this summer called Mounjaro, which works kind of similarly to Ozempic, but it has some additional things. And it's really got some amazing data in terms of weight loss. It's not yet approved for that indication. It's only approved for type 2 diabetes, but that's another one that I think, again, moving forward, we may see some really compelling numbers there that help you know, increase the use of these medications overall. But yeah, they're not, we're still not at the magic bullet, you know, point where we can promote, you know, 100 pounds of weight loss with a single drug.
Dr. Davis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Dawn Belt Davis, director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, and section chief of endocrinology at the VA in Madison. She joined us for a look at the diabetes medication called Ozempic and why it's being used as a possible weight loss drug. Coming up after the news, we look at the latest national job numbers and what they could mean for the Federal Reserve's next move on interest rates. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.